And then professionalism came along in 1996. And you were offered a professional contract by Gloucester. And you reinvented yourself as a number eight.
Yeah.
Which always seemed your natural position. At least it did as soon as you started playing in it.
Well, when I said, I mean, I mentioned that, you know, with Mike Burton's comment when I was a kid, and that, so it was always in the back of my mind, and I thought, I was getting a lot of rugby in, you know, in the United week in, week out. I was enjoying the rugby, and I was playing in, you know, the first two games we talked about there, pre-professionalism. So I probably wouldn't, it was, the only, the reason I made the move was actually Dave Spencer, who you might recall, he played in the back row then a few years, and he was coaching the United at the time, and he kept saying, you know, we need to try in the back row, I think we need an eight down here, and so I went down to a nice little induction down to Rodney Parade in Newport in the traditional monsoon of rain and mud on a Wednesday night, and said, "Oh, it's a nice induction," and played at eight, and you know, we went pretty well, I think, and playing that game, and then obviously the opportunity came up over the summer to say, "Well, okay, we're going to go into a professional game." You know, we had some conversations with Richard Hill and saying, "I'm going to play you at eight." And which, to be honest, I think I was always known that, you know, if the game was going to be professional, that's probably where I'm going to end up playing.
Because you weren't perhaps tall enough to be a professional lock.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to look at the attributes. I played against Martin Bayfield, jumped against Bayfield. He's 6 foot 10, 11, and I stopped him winning a ball and one ball, just because those days you could use elbows, arms, anything. Yeah. It was a little bit more of a. But as the game got a little, the line got a bit more structures, more gaps, all of a sudden it became difficult to spoil opposition ball. And I think, you know, that the tall, lean, you know, 6 foot six, 6 foot seven became the norm. It just was an obvious choice for me. I mean, I think I always had quite a bit of pace. If you looked at me run, you wouldn't have thought that. But, you know, based on track times. So I think I had all the attributes for a back row player. So made that transition, but I had a couple of games at Blindside pre-professionalism, and playing Wasps at here when Mike Teague was at eight, and I played at six. So I kind of dabbled with it, but not really stuck at it, because obviously there's a lot of back row players. You know, the game at six, all of a sudden, oh, we need a second row. We want Dev to get back in the second row, and we've got our back row fit again. So it was you can become a bit like, you know, the utility players are in the backs. So you get caught between two stalls. So. The professionalism was where I said, right, that's it, eight.
With the onset of professionalism, were there quick changes on and off the field, or was it a gradual process? Was it noticeable as soon as the professional came in?
Yeah, it was a big change, because obviously, so over the summer, the game went open. So towards the end of the last season of amateur rugby, if you call it, there was... Gloucester started paying little retainers to players who they wanted to keep around, because the realism was, if you didn't do that, there was other clubs doing it proactively, and you'd end up with no squad come the start of the professional era. So it was always going that way. After, and the South Africa World Cup in 95 was the big watershed moment, where everyone woke up and said, we've got to do something in this country. So over the summer, people, you know, like myself, I had a 10-year career and engineering background, so I mean, other people have businesses, so you have to make a decision. You know, do you continue with that and continue doing part-time playing, which some people did, or do you go full bore at it? And I think the people who kept the part-time option eventually sort of dropped off, because the game grew and grew in terms of training, such that, you know, you couldn't afford to miss the sessions you were missing. You started to fall behind. So Richard Hill came in over the summer. There was a lot more structure to things. You know, things like diet sheets were coming out. And training in the day is the biggest thing I can remember. What it did feel like at first, it felt like you were trying to find things to fill the time. It felt, you know, it was quite alien. You know, so if you bear in mind, we in the amateur days, I mean, so club training was, when it moved Tuesday, Thursday, then I used to go to the gym. I used to work all day, gym Monday night. I was home at 9, next day, work all day, train Tuesday night, next day, Wednesday night, gym, Thursday night, train. So your time was full up all week. You have a Friday off and a Saturday, and all of a sudden then you're going from, well, I haven't got to work in the day. And it was really, I can remember having a conversation with Deeks We were out here doing some line outs, and I said to him, I said, I can't believe this. We're doing line out practice in the winter in daylight, and in the day, I should be. And it felt alien. You really had to get your mind around it to sort of. You almost felt a bit guilty that you're not working because you left school and you come through that over a 10-year process. That's what you did. You know, you almost institutionalised, I suppose, where you get up, you go to work, you train, get up, go to work, you train, and all of a sudden you got acres of this time to fill. Mm. So it was a big. It's a big mental experience as much as anything else. I think if you speak to anyone, you know, if you speak to Hilly and people like that now, or with what they know now, it was a massive learning curve. You know, things are vastly different. I think you could probably been a bit, we could probably been a bit smarter with the training we did. I think there's a tendency to try and run yourself into the ground at every session to justify the fact that you're a professional rugby player, rather than being smart about it and saying, well, what do you really need to do to make us a better player on the Saturday?
Mm-hmm. We got the same feedback from Deeks, and we got the same feedback from Martin Roberts as well, that they were a little bit disorientated, weren't quite sure, you know, of how to fill their time. Appreciated that it was fantastic to be devoting all your time to playing rugby, the thing that they always wanted to do, but the routine had gone.
Yeah.
The routine of the week had gone.
Well, exactly that, and you get to that. I mean, it's kind of a guilt's the right word, but you feel a little bit like, well, this is all a little bit false, and you know, this is, you're always conscious because, you know, as well as at 26, 27, that this is a short term thing, and you want to make the most of it. And then you in the back of your mind thinking, well, you know, what are you going to do? Because you're used to working, what are you going to do work wise once this all ends? And you're almost thinking about that before you've started.
Yeah.
This new career, really. So it was a strange time, but over a period of months, you got more used to it. And even since say 2000, the players have almost come into it from school. Mm. It's just natural, and they wouldn't give it a second thought. I think the flip of that is that players now have to always be conscious of the fact that, you know, rugby career doesn't last forever. You need to work beyond that, whereas the guys then, like myself, we always had something to fall back on.
Yeah, yeah. How did it affect the social side of the game? I mean, was the transition there quick?
Well, in terms of having a beer after the games? So I think it was still a little bit old school when it went professional. Because you're training so hard, I can speak from personal, because you're training so hard, your body gets more... finely tuned, if you like. So I find you physically couldn't drink like you used to anyway. And I mean, I don't want to say this like you used to drink a huge amount. We always used to. You train in the week. On a Thursday after training, you might go and have a few drinks locally, and then on your Saturday night was your big blowout, you know, regardless. And then you were disciplined throughout the rest of the week. But I think you're always a bit more conscious when you're professional that you know, you've got heavy lot of training. Your recovery was always considered as well. You know, if you've picked a big knockout, the last thing you want to be doing is drinking a load of alcohol and stuff that's going to make your recovery 3 days rather than one. So, and again, over time, I think your mindset shifted and realised that, you know, your body, you get to know your body very well, you know, inside out, and you know what makes you tick, how much can you drink, for example, that you feel you can deal with for the next 2 days, and how much, you know, you don't. But it was certainly not, just to put it the other way, it was certainly not, oh, we're going to start drinking orange squash now, because the mentality was, and I still maintain this now, you're better off going flat out of training, putting everything on the line, and going having a couple of beers. Because we saw people come down in those early stages, you know, and they'd drift through training, and then they'd sit there with an orange juice and lemonade or an orange squash after, and, you know, we used to say to them, and it was quite a harsh environment, you know, in those days, and you kind of said, you're better off putting yourself about in training and having a couple of pints and sat there doing that. And it was, you know, because it was kind of a bit of work hard, play hard mentality. I mean, the game's moved on so much now that, you know, of course the players like to drink now and again, but you do really have to you look after yourself.